Thursday night on the Fan pregame. Ailish and Justin, a lot on the show tonight. We're pregaming some hockey on the network, of course. Pittsburgh and New Jersey up at 7, Tampa Bay and Vegas at 10, and then regionally Buffalo and Vancouver. GM meetings wrapping up in Florida, like a smorgasbord of new rules proposed. We're going to go through some of those. Sean Reynolds will also join us in a few minutes to break it all down. And I just need to say, one day we need to get on the GM meetings beat because it looks nice.
Yeah, it does look nice. Looks like a pretty good assignment. Another good assignment would be the NCAA tournament. We're just moments away from it actually officially starting with the first four. But, you know, in earnest, doesn't really begin until Thursday afternoon. But to preview March Madness, the new voice of March Madness and a man who spends an enviable amount of time with our boy Charles Davis, CBS's Ian Eagle will come on in about a half hour.
I love it. We're 9 days away from the season beginning in MLB. Blue Jays announcing that Jose Barrios will be the opening day starter, plus Joey Votto worked on his curse of writing. We also worked on our curse of writing. Behind-the-scenes look will be posted on social in about an hour. Justin, Holly, Mike, and myself did a cursive writing challenge, and I think that was the first time we had written in cursive writing since we were all in elementary school, and it did not go well.
Yeah, I feel differently about his Twitter post.
I'm extremely impressed
that I've actually wrote cursive myself since.
Like I the behind the scenes, I tried to get them to write one sentence, and it took over a minute and a half on average for us to pump out
like
four words.
15 seconds per word.
It's difficult. So
it
shout
difficult.
Out Joey Votto for reminding us that we did learn that once.
And of course, best bets, March Madness, a big night in the NHL, P-Dub tonight, a lot to go through when we do the bet segment.
Okay, quickly before we bring in Sean, who's basking in the sun, waiting to hear our questions. A couple new rules proposed. Now, they're not solidified yet, but they've been floated into the atmosphere. And on Twitter, and you know what happens when that happens. We all get to debate. New rule, Justin. You either like it, love it, or you'd want to dump it. Like, dump and change. What are those words that, you know, you've used the saying? Bench, start, cut. That's it.
Sure.
Leg over bench. A player will be warned.
I'm going to bench the leg over bench.
A player will be warned if caught with a skate over the bench followed by a minor penalty. A referee was cut by a skate, which motivated the rules. So it's a nice context.
I mean, I get it, but like, you know how we get like irrationally excited about a player that just wants to get on the ice so bad? We're gonna miss that now. But if someone got cut, I mean, I'm okay with that.
I just think like, you know, there's bigger fish to fry here than somebody eager to get on the ice. It's important.
Based on the other rules.
It's important. Dislodging the net. Rule 63.A4. Adding goalie to list of players who can get a penalty for intentionally dislodging the net. Now, I actually think there's something here.
Yeah, call it the Matt Murray rule. We kind of like, whatever. It probably is justifiable that a goaltender can't purposely knock it off, but are we going to get penalties for just going hard from post to post? I don't want to see that.
Goalie pull. If a goalie is pulled by concussion, spotter, or injury, replacement gets a warm-up.
I think that's reasonable.
The games are getting longer and longer with all these new rules.
I can start that. Give them a couple shots.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to get out there?
Yeah.
Do like the horseshoe drill?
I'll be like the e-bug.
Yeah, there you go.
The e-shug.
Goalie mask. If a goalie loses his mask and play is blown dead, other team gets an offensive zone draw with choice of dot. Choice of dot is big. No matter where the puck is on the ice.
I guess that's fine.
Okay, so you seem to be just cruising through
this.
Well,
these are all so trivial. Like, we're all going to Florida to come up with this stuff?
That's what I'm saying. I need to get to Florida. Last one. New coaches challenge. If a penalty is called for puck over the glass, they can ask for a video review to prove it did hit something. This is only for when a penalty is called. Cannot be used to call a penalty on another team. Key, if you are wrong on this challenge, it's then a 5-on-3.
It seems like a little bit silly, but also because all these teams have video rooms that know this stuff way before
it
happens.
You're only calling it when it,
like,
you know.
They're never going to, 99% of the time, they're going to get it right, which I guess is fine. But again, more review, which I'm not really into.
Okay, there's this and more important things maybe on the table down in Florida. Let's bring in Sean Reynolds, Sportsnet reporter. Down in Florida, Sean, we need to get on the beat of being in the GM meetings because if this is the stuff you guys are talking about and hitting the beach and having margaritas, and I need to get added to next year's guest list.
Listen, I feel like we're not being appreciated for the long, hard days of work that are happening down here. Listen, there's a bunch of us Sportsnet people down here grinding. We will bear that cross for everybody else. If you want to be appreciative about it, we'll take that, but we'll keep doing our job. But it may not be the cakewalk you think it is, or it may. We'll keep those secrets to ourselves.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of secrets over there. But maybe you can divulge a little bit, because you're with Elliot Friedman, and I feel like the red carpet gets rolled out wherever he goes. So what's it like being in Elliot's orbit?
Yeah, it's like I said, these hits, and for those who would be watching this on TV, usually it's a little bit of where's Waldo, where's Elliot in the background. You'll usually find him by the pool with, you know, a drink in his hand. But to be honest, I've said this. A lot of people always ask me what it's like working with Elliot. I mean, he will be a Hall of Fame broadcaster, but he is right at the very top of the pyramid when it comes to colleagues. I mean, he's always got time for everybody. He works like nobody else. But yet is still able to, you know, make sure he makes the time for everybody. Went out last night. It was Eric Engel's birthday. Elliot picked up the tab. Hey.
Wow, Elliot.
First round draft pick of a teammate. I got to tell you that.
Which will go through the company, I guess, a little bit later.
Yeah.
We talked about how some of these ideas maybe, or these new rules, maybe somewhat trivial, like it's not going to change the game dramatically. But I guess there might be some ideas that would at least hit some sort of standard above what we're going to see. Have you heard anything crazy that's not being implemented, but an idea that's been kicked around that's a little bit offbeat and maybe something a little interesting?
Well, I think you touched on most of them. For me, the theme of what we're seeing here is they're trying to create they're trying to eliminate those little areas of the game where a team, if they feel like they're getting overwhelmed, can maybe get out of it, right? So you were talking about not liking the idea of not allowing the goalie to go hard from, you know, post to post or something like that. But there's been a little bit of a scenario at times where, you know, if you've been locked into your zone for 2 minutes and the goaltender says, hey, if I go hard into the post to make that save and pop the net off, it's a little bit of a get out of jail free card. So I think they're trying to create a lot of these scenarios where what they're doing is just basically think of treating it like an icing. At one time, you used to be able to ice the puck, and that was your ability to kind of alleviate that pressure. Well, now you ice the puck, you can't change. It goes to whichever dot the opposing team wants. They're trying to take away those little, you know, get trap doors, those get out of jail free cards. And so I think they're just trying to get a little bit more consistent. And if you think of it from that perspective, you understand the NHL wants teams to put other teams under pressure, and they don't want those teams to have the ability to get out of that pressure through, you know, holes in the rule book. So that was definitely something that they were focusing on today.
We've been scouring the internet for, I guess, tweets and more information about what's being talked about. And I think there's been a lack of maybe transparency if there's any LTIR discussions. Is that something you think for the off season might be more of a deeper dive? Obviously, the Vegas Golden Knights are holding their breath that this doesn't get changed too quickly. But seriously, it is something that fans are interested in, and I'm sure GMs would be interested in if they would change the LTIR rules.
Yeah, so one of the things with that is you have to get the players' union involved in that, right? If you want to make any kind of decisions that are going to have an effect on how players get paid or how many players are going to get paid, you have to bring the union into it. So it's not that easy. Everyone has to be on board with those changes. But, you know, I've said this before. I covered the 2015 Cup Final between the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Chicago Blackhawks. We think of the Lightning as being the original team that really, you know, some people think it's cheating through LTIR, but like having that roster that is getting paid way more than what they should be getting paid. Well, in 2015, Chicago was that team, and Tampa was upset with it, and Tampa proposed rules that would change that. And of the other teams in the NHL, not one of them supported taking that away. So I think personally what happens in these situations is there are certain teams that have been able to find a way to use it really well. Tampa was that for a number of years. Right now, it's the Vegas Golden Knights. I do think the importance of the potential of winning a Stanley Cup means that if you're a GM that gets close, you don't want to get into a situation where injuries blow up your ability to go there, or you also want every tool at your disposal to try and put that pennant up in the rafters. So while teams don't like it when it's being done to them, I still think the urge to have the ability for them to one day do that themselves is the overarching feeling here that people want to to go with. So I don't expect a lot to be done on this, and that hasn't been a big conversation here.
Yeah, I do think it's a little bit of a surprise that it's not a conversation, but I do think you're right in that, like, yeah, if you lose a significant player, it's something you really need to explore in order to make sure that you're not missing an opportunity. And if you're scheduling surgeries because, hey, you can schedule it right on when they're going to come back and it makes the most sense, like, I guess that's what you got to do nowadays in order to be at your best come playoff time. In terms of things that will actually change the game, because we were talking about like legs over the boards, like that's not like it's a good idea for health and safety, but it's not going to change the game. The 5-on-3s, though, for a failed challenge for a puck over glass or a high stick, that is interesting to go to 5-on-3. How did they arrive at 5-on-3 and going beyond the typical, okay, incur a minor penalty for delay a game?
So just a quick clarification on the leg over the board and the hands over the board, sticks over the board. That rule already exists. It's not a rule change. What the NHL has said is there are situations they didn't like that ref got cut not that long ago by a skate blade. But that rule has always existed. You're not allowed to do that. It's just something they haven't called a lot. So the direction now towards officials is saying going forward, give a warning, then give a penalty. So that's nothing new. What's new is that they're actually really going to look to enforce that. But you talked about it. The thing to me that is the biggest news coming out of this is the ability that they're trying to open up, that they're looking at, that they may pass for head coaches to be able to challenge the idea of was the puck over glass or are we getting improperly penalized? Same thing with being able to review high sticks. It's important to note that a coach can't say that the other team, you know, the officials missed the other team shooting it over the glass and get the, you know, give them a penalty that was not assessed. That is a Pandora's box the NHL does not want to open up, the idea of being able to take review and call penalties that were missed, because you never know where that could go. But what they wanted to do is they said, we want to open this up and we want to make sure that in every situation you don't feel like you're losing on a completely unfair play. But they're not so sure how much this is needed, and the numbers would back that up, and I'm hoping I'm getting this right. I had it right earlier today, but I believe there's been 234, I think that was the number, 234 puck over glass penalties called so far this year, and the NHL's reviewed the tape, and only two of those calls did the officials get wrong. So this is really not, in the mind of the NHL, a massively pressing problem, and what they don't want this to turn into is a situation, again, to relieve pressure or get, you know, a sneaky timeout in there. So they wanted to make sure that, okay, we're going to give you the ability to go down these roads with the high stick, with the puck over the glass, but we think we're doing a good job calling this already. If you don't, you better be 100% sure that you're getting this right, because if you get it wrong, it's going to create a potential game-changing scenario.
Those are good stats. I'm surprised that it's that little, but that's maybe, you know, illustrates how this is not necessarily going to impact things at a very stark degree. There's been a lot of complaints, or there was complaints earlier in the season from general managers reportedly about overtime and how overtime is more boring and is not what it was expected to be or drawn up to be originally. And yet we don't really hear much, at least from Florida, or we haven't heard much from down south about potential changes to the overtime format. Was it discussed this week?
It was discussed. Sorry, just to backtrack quickly, I did get those numbers right. 234 nice. Puck over glass penalties. You may
That's
not be impressed. I'm extremely impressed with myself right now. I'm surprised I pulled that off. But it was a big conversation, and this was one of those scenarios where the GMs took a look at this. They really dug into 3-on-3 overtime, asked a lot of questions, and decided that the best change in this case was no change at all. And I think what they were really looking at was the idea of the reload, right? When the team gets possession of the puck and they go and they try and break into the offensive zone and try something and they don't like what it looks like, so they just leave the zone and come back in and try it again. And there was concern that maybe that was taking away from the game, and that's quite honestly an artificial situation. They don't do that in the middle of the first, second, or third period where they do the reload like that. So I think they were concerned maybe that's an artificial situation that we want out. But what they found was a team will – basically gain position at the beginning of an overtime, and they'll do that once, maybe twice, maybe three times. But then when they go in and try and pounce for that chance, it's a turnover, and then the other team goes the other way, and it's a great odd man rush, and then they don't score, and it's a turnover, and it comes back the other way. So I think what they're really concerned about is that they don't want games to be longer. So they don't want to blow the whistle and penalize a team and say, hey, listen, we need you really pushing the pace. I think they're okay with the idea that if a three on three overtime is 5 minutes, and that's what it ends up being with the whistles, they're okay with that. Another thing that they talked about was the potential of adding more time to see if games could come to a conclusion before it got to the shootout. One of the things they looked at was the East Coast Hockey League, which has a 7-minute overtime, so it has a higher completion rate in overtime. But if you take a look at the players that are going to be playing in those overtimes, it's the star players, right? We just saw a really, really great overtime game between the Edmonton Oilers, the Colorado Avalanche. We saw McDavid and Draisaitl all over the ice. We saw Rantanen and McKinnon all over the ice. It's the stars who get the extra minutes piled on them in overtime. So if you're going to add another 2 minutes, it's just more time those stars have to play. And I think they looked at the idea that they didn't want more whistles. They don't think it's as big of a problem. And a solution of adding more time just really adds more onto the backs of your star players. So they reviewed it and found that the best change, again, is no change at all.
We're chatting with Sean Reynolds ahead of, or at the end of here, of GM meetings in Florida. So not only do you get to go to Florida, but you get to cover the Winnipeg Jets quite often, and they are having one hell of a season. So you're kind of a lucky guy here in the Sportsnet world. What's been the best part of the Jets being a wagon this season? They're the first in the Central right now. They're really fun to watch. We had Kevin Cheveldayoff on right after the trade deadline, and he's had an incredible 12 months where he's put this team together. You're around him all the time. What's the energy like in Winnipeg?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things. First and foremost, the idea that I don't know how many people would have had the Winnipeg Jets being one of the best teams in the NHL this year. Never mind the idea that in the summertime, I think a lot of people thought there was going to be a teardown and a rebuild. So it's a really good place for them to be in. One of the things that I find really amazing is that if you remember last year at the end of when they lost out in that first round, Rick Bowness really went at his players in the media. The players went after Rick Bowness in the media. We weren't sure if they were going to be able to bridge that gap, and instead they came out and, in my opinion, got to their game faster than any other team in the NHL. We're a really, really structured group and have found a really, you know, structured game that's made them the best defensive team in the NHL. Another thing that they've done really good this year, I think they're the best team in the NHL at winning the games that good teams should win. Like, we see all the time, you'll get, you know, really good teams will go out and they'll play good, and then all of a sudden the Anaheim Ducks or the San Jose Sharks or the Columbus Blue Jackets will come rolling into town, and all of a sudden they'll lose to that team. Taking a look at the Columbus Blue Jackets, I think they've won 3 games in their last 14, I think is the stat, but two of those wins come against the Vegas Golden Knights and the Edmonton Oilers. Mm. The Jets don't lose those games for the most part. Since Christmas time, I think the stat is that they are 19-3-1 against those teams. So the Jets, when it's time to be focused against a team that you could play down to, for the most part, play to the standard they need to win those games. It's why they're in first place. The concern right now with the Winnipeg Jets is since Christmas time, they aren't beating the better teams, the teams above that playoff line. So if you think about it, lately they've been, you know, they've won 2 in a row, but before that, they lose a game against the Nashville Predators, who came in and left no doubt on that night that the Nashville Predators were the better team. The game before that, they win that game 3-0 against Washington. The game before that, they lose 4-0 to the Vancouver Canucks, and that game wasn't close. They got waxed by the Vancouver Canucks. So their record is around, their points percentage is about 0.33% against teams above the playoff line right now. And hey, it looks great. They're in first place. They keep racking up points because they're beating the below the line playoff teams, but they're not going to play those teams in the playoffs. So they need to get to a place where they're starting to win again against the really good teams. Tonight, a perfect, perfect measuring stick game for them as they take on the New York Rangers.
Last one for you, Sean, before we let you get back to the Sun for what's remaining, the remainder of it. You mentioned there's no picnics in the playoffs, but the difference between finishing first and second maybe as drastic, or a third, I guess, maybe as drastic for the Jets than any other team, just given who else is in that division. Is it pretty clear the rest of the way? Like, gotta secure the first seed because it could be so impactful?
I think for the Jets, this is one of those scenarios where actually having as many games as they can in their home building is important, more so for the money, for the ticket sales than anything else. I take a look at this scenario and, you know, if they finish first, their reward may be the Vegas Golden Knights, right? The LTIR Kings right now, and what are they capable of? Or they take on the Nashville Predators, and boy, oh boy, the hottest team in the NHL right now, and they've showed it at every turn. If they fall into second, you know, they could be playing either the Dallas Stars or the Colorado Avalanche. There are zero free spaces in the West on the bingo card right now. So my take on this is I don't really think it matters if they finish first, second, or third as far as it comes to playing, you know, playing the games and winning. I've had conversations with head coaches before that say that really the home ice advantage is not that big of a deal in the playoffs. And when I say coaches, I'm talking about successful coaches that have gone all the way and proven that in their minds. But for you know, you've probably had conversations about it in the past this year, the attendance at Winnipeg Jets games, it's not what it was the first 10 years they were there. So the playoffs are a time to, you know, pad the bank account. And I think for the Winnipeg Jets, I have no doubt about it. Every playoff game the Winnipeg Jets play, the whiteout will arrive and they will sell out every single seat in that building. They want to have as many of those games as they possibly can. So if it means one extra game per series because they've got the home ice advantage for the Jets, I think it's important for the organization as a whole.
Yeah, you mentioned a big one tonight. They play the Rangers, top of the Metro. It's going to be a bit of a battle down the stretch. We appreciate your time, Sean. Enjoy the rest of Florida. Say hi to Elliot. And we'll definitely be chatting while the Winnipeg Jets make hopefully a lengthy playoff run.
No doubt. Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much. Sean Reynolds of Sportsnet, of course, ahead of what's going to be a big one tonight. And he's down at NHL GM meetings. We went through some of the rules, went through some of the things that were probably still on our wish list maybe to be talked about, but maybe that's in the offseason.
Yeah, we could be tapping in Sean a lot. You know, it's going to be tough out there in the Central, but if they get that first seed, and again, there's no picnics, but yeah, the whiteout could be cooking for a couple rounds. It's a good team.
They do need the money, too.
If they get the first seed, like, I think it is crucial because beating both Dallas and Colorado is going to be really, really difficult. But letting Dallas and Colorado beat up on each other first, that might be the key to getting to a conference final. And the key to what?
Wild.
10, 11 whiteouts, which again would be very, very important for Winnipeg.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch how the Western Conference playoffs shake out. Obviously, there's still playoff spots on every corner being fought for. That last night, the Washington Capitals, the win, like they are in a playoff spot and Penguins aren't. There's lots of important hockey down the stretch. We've got Pittsburgh and New Jersey. They're still kind of duking it out. They're up after us on Sportsnet. Sportsnet 1's got Tampa Bay and Vegas at 10 o'clock, and then Pacific has Buffalo and Vancouver at 10 o'clock. I feel like every night it's a must-watch hockey games because lots on the line.
Indeed. It seems like we're kind of dragging in some ways, and then in other factions and other areas, like every game is unbelievably important. It's kind of tough, especially in the Atlantic, because it just seems like Boston, Florida are obviously dueling for the top seed, but a team like Toronto, not really moving. I guess Vancouver, not really moving as well. But when it comes to the Jets, the Oilers, really, really important that they're stacking up wins down the stretch.
Quick Blue Jays update was, we teased it earlier, but it's going to be Jose Berríos having the opening day start for the Blue Jays on March 28th against the Rays. I mean, probably not the ace of the roster, but right now will be taking that role as Kevin Gausman works a little bit behind with his injury, but he should be okay. And it'll be Berríos' second opening day start with the Jays after he started on 2022 against the Rangers. That was a bad one. Let's just erase that one from our minds.
It would be 3 years ago, right? Because it was Manoah, then Gausman. No, it was Manoah last year. You're right. Yeah, Berríos. I mean, it's kind of a good news, bad news scenario because, like, I think everyone loves Jose Berríos.
Oh, big time.
He's like maybe the best approval rating among all of Jays. Maybe not quite, but he's definitely up there. But it definitely is a reminder, oh yeah, Kevin Gausman's not right. And what happens if Kevin Gausman's not right? Well, the strength of this team is no longer the strength of the team, right? So I like to see it. I love to see it for Jose Berríos, but you know what kind of means for the rest of the ecosystem.
We're going to take a quick break. Ian Eagle is going to join us, CBS Sports, a new voice of March Madness. We got lots to go through with him. We got Zach Edey maybe being one of the stars of March Madness. We're going to go through all that and more in the Best Bets to end the show.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Fan Pregame SportsNet. It's SportsNet 590. The Fan, it's an exciting week. This month is like the peak of sports. We're getting right into it. Masters around the corner. You got March Madness. Spring, finally. Playoffs are coming around the corner for NBA, NHL. MLB is about to start. This is like peak sports watching time.
This is the best time, or we are approaching the best time.
We're right at the cusp.
Yeah, we're at the cusp.
We're right there. I do need to create the bracket, I think, for Sportsnet because nobody sent it to us.
There was a retirement, apparently.
And I think it feels like it's my responsibility as the
vibes coordinator.
As the vibes coordinator and only,
self-proclaimed vibes
and,
coordinator.
You know, only female, and I will say most females are more organized than the man. So I should probably just do it tonight.
Bit of a generalization when you say
yeah, have you organized any brackets? No. So
I'm not an organized person.
I'm going to do it then tonight. I'm going to send out a bracket
one
to our Sportsnet employees.
Okay.
Get us going because it's on the record. Time. It's very important times for us to have some, you know, some fun in the office. Ian Eagle of CBS Sports joins us today. Ian, thanks so much for jumping on. It's great to hear your voice. Great to have you in the mix. And you got to say hi to our guy, Charles Davis. He's one of my favorite people, and you get to see him a lot. So it's like the meshing of all my favorites in one.
Yes, I had Charles Davis on my bingo card within the first 10 seconds of the intro.
Perfect.
I knew it was happening. I felt it.
It's a lock.
I hope we get the rest of the squares and you get bingo, but that's the easy, it's a free square.
So you work with a legend on Sundays. You're taking over for a legend now in Jim Nantz as you are now the voice of the NCAA tournament for CBS. What's it like? You know, we just mentioned the word cusp. You're on the cusp of taking over and, you know, being the lead voice for a tournament that captures especially your nation more than any other. What's the feeling this week for you?
Yes. Yeah, I would use the word precipice. I think it's an excellent word, just like cusp, but very similar in the description of where we are. You're right. The madness is here. The dancing has started. For me, it has not changed a whole lot. I haven't, you know, woken up in the morning feeling any different about where I am, where my life is. It's the same preparation that I've done the last 26 years in covering the NCAA tournament. The difference is that there's one more weekend. There's a finality to it. You go right through to the championship game. And you're right. Succeeding Jim Nantz in this role after he did it for 33 years is a responsibility. And that's how I view it. But with that said, I'm not going to change the way I do the games. I'm not going to change the way that I prepare and try to get ready for the games. It's the same every year. You get your eight teams and then you are completely engaged in the process of getting to know the eight teams and being able to provide the energy, excitement, and passion for what these games produce. It really is an exciting event, and it's one of a kind. When you get the one game knockout, there's always angst and pressure. And if you're a higher seed, you feel it. If you're a lower seed, you look at it as your opportunity to make a name for yourself and create some history. And our four games in Brooklyn, you've got all these different storylines that really bring March Madness into the consciousness. And I'm here for it. I'm here for all of it.
When you were like 10, 12 years old, like what did the tournament mean to you? Like if you were going to tell 10 to 12-year-old Ian that, hey, I'm going to be calling the Final Four, like, what would that have been like?
Yeah, so the first thing I would have told 10-year-old Ian is, hey, don't be offended when people call you Ian for the rest of your life. Just accept it.
Yeah,
it's okay. It's not that big a deal. If you go to Starbucks, Just say Ian, so you avoid the whole, what is it, Ian, Ian? You have no idea what they're going to write on your cup anyway, so just live with it. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say, it's funny you bring up 10-year-old version of me, because the 10-year-old version of me was in 1979 watching the NCAA championship game between Michigan State and Indiana State and Magic Johnson against Larry Bird. And that is the first NCAA title game that I can clearly remember where I was, who I was with, what I was thinking, captured by the whole pomp and circumstance of this game and this event. And I was just blown away. I was amazed. I was amazed at their individual talent. I was amazed at just how big it felt. And that was clearly a shift in college basketball. The year before, Kentucky beat Duke. My old broadcast partner, Jim Spanarko, played in that game. Duke lost to the Wildcats, and Jack Goose Givens had the game of his life. And that's a national championship for Kentucky. But I have no recollection of that. I didn't know the word Spanarko when I was nine. But I knew at 10 what was happening in the NCAA tournament. And I would tell that version of myself, buckle up, because this thing is such a fun, high-energy event.
Don't worry, with a name like Eilish, I have multiple Starbucks fake names that I just reel out there.
You don't roll with it, though. That's the only difference.
I also get English and Eyelash and Amish. So, you know, Ian and I, and I'm in the same boat as you. So one thing that's really unique into the last couple of years, we haven't seen a repeat champion since 2007. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's a lot of steam and momentum that this might be the year that that trend changes. Is that where you're leaning towards when you start to look at your big predictions for this upcoming March Madness?
Yeah, it's funny. So the first year I did the tournament was 1998. I was still working at WFAN Radio in New York at the time, and we would have the same brackets you would have in every office in America. And I was into it and had won it a couple of years, so I felt good about my knowledge, about my chances, and I filled out a bracket that year. And I fly out to Sacramento to call my four games. And this is pre-internet, pre-smartphone. So the only thing I can go off of is the bottom line scrolling scores at the bottom of my screen that were updating the other sites. And I found myself, as I was calling games that involved Maryland and Arizona and Illinois State and Utah State and Nicholls State, I'm calling these games. And I'm staring at the bottom line, getting angry at the games that I'm blowing in my bracket. Like, are you kidding me? I screwed that up. And that was the last time I filled out a bracket. Mm-hmm. Literally, I have never filled out a bracket since that year. I just realized what a distraction it was to do the job. With that said, everything you laid out in regards to UConn is true. They look like a bomb squad. They look like a true power. I had them a couple of weeks ago in a game against Seton Hall and Storrs, and their talents were on full display. Tristan Newton was tremendous, and Donovan Klingon was dominant, and Stephon Castle looked every bit like a lottery pick. They check every box. Their head coach, Dan Hurley, is just in that zone, pushing all the right buttons, has a great feel for his team. They can beat you in different ways. You want to go up and down with them, you'll probably lose. You want to get into a half-court battle with them? Well, they've got the pieces, because Klingon can just take over in the paint, and they have jump shooters. Newton makes threes. Cam Spencer, one of the best three-point shooters in the country. Castle can get to the rim. Caravan makes threes. They've got role players in Diarra, Samson Johnson. Now Jalen Stewart has become part of the eight-man rotation. So that repeat possibility, and you're talking about Billy Donovan in Florida, it's in jeopardy. It might happen. They're good enough to do it. They're the number one overall seed, and what we've seen in recent years is the number one overall seed doesn't normally do well in the NCAA tournament, but they might be the exception to the rule.
Yeah, I think they're minus money to get through the regional. I think they're plus 450 to win the whole thing. They're heavy, heavy favorites, and yet I think some UConn fans feel slightly aggrieved by the draw, right? Because they've got Auburn in their quadrant. Illinois might be a strong three. Definitely Auburn a strong four. Is there something to that? Like, did UConn not get a bad draw, but is it more difficult than, you know, your normal threes and fours in this tournament, or your average threes and fours in this tournament that they might have to deal with. UConn, definitely the number one overall seed, but maybe the draw didn't totally reflect that.
And I would tell you, just to add to it, and I think you said it perfectly, the one aspect I would add, I think they got the best number two seed also in their quadrant, and that's Iowa State. To me, they were a fringe number one seed along with North Carolina. That's how good Iowa State is. I saw them earlier this season in a victory at home over Kansas. I just love the way they play. I think T.J. Otzelberger has done outstanding work there and building the team and his image and how he wants to play. So you could put that on the board as well, that UConn is dealing with a challenge and a tough road. But you want to win a championship? Odds are you're probably going to face it. I look back just in doing the notes at their road from last year, and the road last year wasn't as tough. Mm-hmm. Iona, St. Mary's, Arkansas, Gonzaga, Miami, San Diego State. Those are the teams that they beat in the NCAA tournament. You can only control what you can control. And yes, of course, we look at their area of the draw and say, well, if the two seed and the three seed and the four seed all advance, that's going to be really challenging. Odds are it's not going to play out that way, and someone's going to get clipped along the way.
They do say pressure makes diamonds, so maybe like having a harder route will make you stronger in the end. I'm just trying to give them some hope. You talked about your bingo card. Well, I think talking about Canada's Zach Edey would probably be one of the squares, so we're going to give you that one as well. Obviously, he's become a household name here at Purdue, going to have, hopefully, a lengthy career at NBA level. But I wonder for you, like, obviously Canada, we know, we appreciate, we respect, we anticipate his future. But what's the stardom level for Zach Edey south of the border? Is he a superstar in NCAA basketball? Is he on the verge of becoming a household name, or are we living in a bit of a Canadian bubble?
It's interesting. It depends on who you talk to. There are NBA people that I've spoken to that feel like there is a definite role for him in the NBA, not necessarily as a star, but someone that can be a productive member of a good team. Mm-hmm. But you have to draft him with that in mind. There has to be a plan. He is not the prototypical modern NBA player anymore. He's from a different era. And in a different era, he would fit in perfectly. In this era of shooting a lot of threes and perimeter-oriented and bigs that invert and go outside and can beat you in different ways, he's an anomaly. So is there a place for him in the NBA? I think there is. The best case scenario in my mind is he gets to a really good organization that has really good development coaches that can maximize what he brings. Right now, with Purdue, what he's been asked to do, plant yourself in the paint, be bigger than everybody, be stronger than everybody, make plays, use your body, and the hope is for Purdue that they can ride that to a championship. I did the game 2 years ago when they got knocked off by St. Peter's in Philadelphia, and to me that was one of the biggest shockers in NCAA tournament history. They did not have the physical profile to match up with Zach Edey, and yet Purdue did not take advantage. They were a bit squeamish and timid in that game, and they empowered St. Peter's over the course of the day. They made them believe. Jaden Ivey, who is a lottery pick and now with the Detroit Pistons, probably the most talented player on the floor, just couldn't get going. And that happens. That happens in this one-and-done format. So for Purdue, there's the big picture, the macro, which is, okay, when's it going to happen? When are they going to make their first Final Four? When are they going to experience the winning that we see during the regular season translate to the postseason? And then there's the micro, which is what you're alluding to. What does this mean for Zach Edey down the road? I'm very curious to see how it all plays out for him individually. I know his focus and the Boilermakers fans' focus is on what's going to happen over the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, they are always one of the most polarizing teams, it seems, like Matt Painter's inability to get it done at the NCAA tournament level, and Zach Edey like rolls up and all that, so clearly it gets our attention north of the border, and they're once again one seed, and there's expectations there, and maybe that same nervousness will draw in. They'll have to overcome that. We're chatting with Ian Eagle, who will call the Final Four for CBS. We're talking about draws earlier. Let's go to the South, because Duke is like the number one team on people's minds normally. Like the average fan thinks about Duke first a lot. And if we're doing draws again, they get Houston and Marquette in their region. And Houston and Marquette are both probably better, but also both dealing with injuries. Do you see a door opening for the Blue Devils?
I do, but the interesting part, I don't know what the reaction has been when you've talked it through with people that like to talk the NCAA tournament. There are a lot of people that think Vermont can knock them off, that this is the type of team that just plays really hard, is really connected, has a chip on their shoulder, will show up not intimidated by the idea of Duke. I think there's recency bias in there, the fact that Duke did not deliver against North Carolina down the stretch of the regular season with all the buildup in that game. And then the fact that they threw up an air ball against NC State, and it turned out to be a magical run for the Wolfpack. But at the time, you think, okay, that's a bad loss. That's an indicator of things are not exactly set up the way that you expected them to be at this time of year in Durham. I look at just the sheer talent, and they got a bunch of NBA players on their team. Duke's got NBA talent in McCain and Filipowski and Proctor and Mitchell. This kid Caleb Foster down the road is probably going to be a factor. Jeremy Roach is much improved from what we saw his first couple of years to what he is today. But what does it equate to under John Shire in year number two? Their confidence has been leveled. They took a shot. The North Carolina thing, I think, really threw them for a loop, and then the additional issues that come with losing in the quarterfinals of the ACC tournament. So you're right that it's open in their region. They got to get past this mental block first, which is Vermont, a team that has always showed up in the NCAA tournament and makes you at least pay attention. John Becker has been a defensive-minded coach, a developmental type of coach, and they got a bunch of new faces, but they're better. They're better than they were a year ago, and then they're in the tournament for the third straight year. So this is not new to them. This is not hey, we're just happy to be there. They believe they can win.
I just have one last quick one for you, Ian. I appreciate your time tonight. Justin and I love getting a chance to talk to someone about NCAA March Madness. It's right around the corner, so we're going to fit one last one in here. One thing that we love, and even if you're not a diehard basketball fan, is like a Cinderella story, something, a team you want to root for, a coach you want to root for, a program that you want to root for. Do you see something that could potentially come about as a Cinderella story, something that pulls on the heartstrings as you start to, you know, picture this March Madness?
I think so. There always is one. Last year was obviously different than previous years because you had Florida Atlantic in the mix and you had San Diego State in the mix, two schools that you don't normally equate to March Madness and the Big Dance. Now they're both in with different expectations. Now they've been there, they've done that, and there's somebody new. One of the games that I'm working is James Madison and Wisconsin. And James Madison fits the profile of what you're alluding to. Mm-hmm. A team that had really no business to be as good as they turned out to be. They're 31-3. I don't care who you are. That's hard to do in Division I basketball. They're playing in the Sun Belt. They went 15-3. In their conference. They went undefeated out of conference. And one of those wins was against Michigan State. So I know the first thought would be, all right, yeah, but who have they played? Well, they beat Michigan State, and now they're playing a Big Ten team, Wisconsin. And I think it's one of those matchups that the NCAA tournament is all about. You have a big team from a big conference, Wisconsin out of the Big Ten, and you have a team out of the Sun Belt Conference, lower conference, that I don't know if people know what their nickname even is. You know, that's where we're at. When you go, oh, yeah, James Madison, the, what are they again? Yeah, the Dukes. Mm-hmm. They're the Dukes. This is one of those stories that could emerge. So if you're asking me, after the first weekend, is there a team that may pop up that captures the imagination of the college basketball public? It could be James Madison.
All right. We'll be monitoring the Dukes, and we'll be monitoring your calls the entire month. Ian, it was a pleasure chatting with you today, and best of luck over the next few weeks.
All right. Good luck. Good luck with your bracket. I'm glad that you're taking over and arranging this. Yeah, I mean, this is on you, Eyelash.
No, yep, Eyelash. It's going to be called Eyelash's Bracket with Ian.
And we'll try to ignore the ticker when we're live tomorrow or on Thursday.
Exactly.
Thanks so much. Have a great month. Appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Well. See ya.
Bye. It's Ian Eagle of CBS. I got a question for you.
That's funny.
Since you're a proud Ivy League graduate, do you...
Bro.
Do you gravitate towards... the Ivy League champions?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's hilarious.
Do you?
We never do much, right?
But these are your hated rivals.
Yeah, but there's
always just
I know.
One,
I
right?
actually had this conversation with one of my good friends, Kate, who went to Yale, and I saw
and Yale's
that
in, right?
Yale had this unbelievable, you know, buzzer beater over Brown, and I sent it to her. She goes, well, "Yeah, our team's actually pretty good." And I'm like, you know, Dartmouth's basketball team wasn't, so I didn't give them too much. But I think it was Princeton that was in last year, and they made a little push, and I was like,
yeah, didn't they beat? Yeah. Did they beat Arizona as a 15?
I was fired up for them because, you know what? We have brains, but we don't have the most prolific sports teams. It's not often that, you get somebody going far in any level of sport when you compare it to across NCAA. So
you wage war internally, but together when you have to go the outside world,
yes, we're
hang
friends.
With the normies,
we're
you,
friends, yeah.
you band together.
You know,
okay.
We want to talk about...
Okay.
calculus and stuff. So
you'd be looking at Yale and the Dukes of James Madison.
I think I'll give them a little love for sure. I mean, I'm not too proud to cheer on my NCAA brethren that had to do big with their SAT subject tests. I'm in.
And you guys can handle hockey.
I'd like to
just
also,
not this year.
Yeah. I'd also like to mention that Daniele Franceschi has messaged me, and we are going to be co-commissioners. That's all
there
it took
go.
Was a public plea for
glad
help.
Glad Daniele is listening.
Daniele
because I thought,
and I are in.
It might be a little flaky, like it wasn't going to happen.
No, it's happening. He's like, I'll set up the group. You make the email. $20 buy-in
and I'm not
seems pretty
I'm not
good.
Surprised that he is.
No, he's fired
he's
up.
Texted you because this is basically
this
a process
is, or his life.
Of giving him a specific amount of money each.
Yeah,
because
he
just dominates
win.
Everyone when it comes to this bracket. So the challenge is really not against each other. It's against Daniele.
Yeah. Producer Mike just goes, co-commissioners, but solo winner. Yes, that will be Daniele.
Yes.
If that'll... there were odds on Daniele winning our bracket, it would be minus 500. Conservatively,
yeah,
that
right.
would be
I think
odds.
You're right. And I might be betting the minus 500. I also might be betting the plus 500 on UConn. However, it's kind of hard
really,
to stomach
eh?
That, right?
You're drinking the UConn
I'm just
Kool-Aid.
Like, I've done some research, looking around, trying to compete with Daniele. And like, no, there's no one else who likes anyone else. It's just UConn, UConn, UConn.
Yeah, you're right. I don't
well, who are you going to say?
No, I don't know. Purdue.
But again, they never win.
But
they always
that's
blow
the thing.
Up.
When I see everybody's bracket, I just Google people's brackets. It's UConn.
Is it UConn?
Winning.
Everyone?
But then there's always obviously another opponent. And I'm like, one day, somebody can do it.
One day. But as we pivot here to our best bets of the night.
You like that, though.
I think what you got to do is if you like UConn, like you just play it with other things you like. Like who do you like winning the Stanley Cup?
Oh, my God. God, Justin.
Okay, not on the spot. Just
well, you
let's say Florida.
Florida. I was just about to say the Florida Panthers.
I would just say parlaying Florida, UConn. Then you're looking at like a better sweat.
What if you do
right?
UConn and the Dodgers and
UConn and the Dodgers?
There you go.
That's what I'm probably going to be
okay.
doing. UConn and the Dodgers.
UConn and the Dodgers and Messi.
Yeah, Inter Miami's not looking so hot though.
Shoot,
because Messi's hurt. I think.
Okay, well, never mind.
But you know, maybe the Dodgers.
Okay,
extend the sweat.
I love that. You're like UConn plus 500. Okay, let's do our best bets then tonight. Mine is a puck line parlay.
Okay.
I was close. I was good. I was on the right track with Kyle Lowry last night, so I'm chasing the big
this
profit
is,
here.
This is aggressive.
Not really.
Who are these teams playing
the
tonight?
The Bruins
Those are
playing the Senators. The Leafs are playing, obviously, the Flyers tonight, and you like them. And the Oilers are playing the Canadians.
That's plus 950?
Plus 950 for them all to win on the puck line. I'm telling you.
Oh, puck line. Okay. Puck line parlay.
Sorry. Puck line parlay.
Okay.
Do it. With a little.
I'll play that with you.
Okay, go.
I'm just going to, well, maybe I want to pick the Leafs now because it's part of the puck line parlay. I'll go with the Lightning instead. It says Leafs on the board, but I'll go Lightning. I like the Leafs tonight as well.
Off, Jen.
I like the Leafs as well. Minus 130. This is like the second time in, what, a week, 10 days, that they've been short favorites over the Flyers. Leafs, also like the Lightning, as dogs tonight.
We could
in Vegas.
We could continue to see history tonight. PWHL Toronto about to drop the puck at Mattamy. Do you think they get their 11th straight win? Like, this is getting
crazy.
Who
they got tonight?
They've got Boston, who's fighting for a playoff spot, just traded for one of the best players on Ottawa.
Toronto wins.
All right. I couldn't even find the odds because they're just... They don't want to lose any more money. All right, that was fun. That was great. Great guest today. Sean Reynolds, Ian Eagle. I'm going to make the bracket, and it'll be ready for all our listeners at Sportsnet tomorrow. Thanks for listening.